Learn more about the fascinating journey of Ibn Battuta, the first ever travel writing by Ibn Jubayr, and the courageous Chinese explorers Hing He. We bring you stories from the travels and lives of nine Muslim explorers that brought us modern-day geography, map-making, and cross-border trade. Mondays to Fridays during Ramadan 2016 at 8:15 a.m. Repeats at 6:50 p.m. The Global Village, the vast expanse of an unknown world discovered. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
At a time when the greatest speed humans could reach was astride a galloping horse, to travel 120,000 kilometers in 30 years was a remarkable feat. At a steady pace, it would have worked out to 10 kilometers per day for almost 11,000 days. The man who traveled that distance was, according to his chronicler, the traveler of the age. He was not the Venetian Marco Polo, but Ibn Battuta of Tangier, who set out eastward in 1325, the year after Polo died. Ibn Battuta's wanderings stretched from Fez to Beijing, and although he resolved not to travel the same path more than once, he made four Hajj pilgrimages to Makkatul Mukarramah, in addition to crossing what on a modern map would be more than 40 countries. He met some 60 heads of state and served as advisor to 24 of them. His travel memoir, known as the Rihla, written after his journeys were complete, names more than 2,000 people whom he met or whose tombs he visited. His descriptions of his life in Turkey, Central Asia, East and West Africa, the Maldives, the Malay Peninsula, and parts of India are a leading source of contemporary knowledge about those areas, and in some cases, they are the only source. His word portraits of sovereigns, ministers, and other powerful men are often uniquely astute and are all the more intimate for being colored by his personal experiences and opinions. Ibn Battuta was born in the port town of Tangier, then an important debarkation point for travelers to Gibraltar, beyond which lay Al-Andalus, Arab Spain, but then reduced from its former extent to include brilliant but beleaguered kingdom of Granada. At age 21, Ibn Battuta set forth at a promising time in history. The concept of the Ummah, of Muslim Brotherhood, had spiritually unified the Muslim world, which stretched from the Atlantic eastward to the Pacific. Islam was the world's most sophisticated civilization during the entire millennium following the fall of Rome. Its finest period was the 800 years between Islam's great first expansion in the 7th and 8th centuries and the advent of European transoceanic mercantilism in the 15th century. During that time, Islam had breathed new life into the sciences, commerce, the arts, literature, law, and governance. Thus, the early 14th century, an era remarkable in Europe for gore and misery, was a magnificent time in Dar al-Islam, the Muslim world. A dozen or more varied forms of Islamic culture existed, all sharing the core values taught in Quran, all influencing each other through the constant traffic of scholars, doctors, artists, craftsmen, and traders. It was an era of superb buildings, both secular and sacred, a time of intellect and scholarship, of the stability of a single faith and law regulating everyday behavior, of powerful economic inventions such as joint ventures, checks, and letters of credit. Ibn Battuta became the first and perhaps the only man to see this world nearly in its entirety. So let us begin with his early days. In Tangier, Shamsuddin Abu Abdullah Muhammad Ibn Abdullah Ibn Muhammad Ibn Ibrahim Ibn Muhammad Ibn Ibrahim Ibn Yusuf Al-Lawati Al-Tanji Ibn Battuta was born into a well-established family of Qadis on February the 25th, 1304, or 723 years after Hijri. Beyond the name of his father and grandfathers that are part of his own name, we know little about his family or his biography. For the Rihla is virtually our sole source of knowledge of him. And it really mentions family matters, which would have been considered private. But we can summarize that like most children of his time, Ibn Battuta would have started school at the age of 6, and his literate life would have begun with the Quran. His class, held in a mosque or at a teacher's home, would in all likelihood have been funded by a waqf, a religious philanthropic trust or foundation, into which the pious could channel their zakat. Ibn Battuta's parents would have paid his teachers an additional modest sum in installments due when the boy achieved certain well-defined milestones. The curriculum of a 14th century classroom would, in some ways, look remarkably up-to-date today. Learning, in the first instance, meant the Qur'an, but for urban children, especially, it did not stop there. Elementary arithmetic was obligatory, for everyone needed to be able to carry on everyday transactions. Secondary education transmitted the bulk of what are now termed vocational skills, including the more complex calculations needed for such practical purposes, such as the division of an estate among heirs, the surveying of land, or distribution of profits from a commercial venture. Tertiary or higher education, however, was as much about character development as the subjects taught. Foremost were the refinements of Arabic grammar, since Arabic was not only the language of the Quran, but also the language of all educated, let alone scholarly. Discourse and the Muslim lingua franca from Timbuktu to Canton. Other subjects taught would have included history, ethics, law, geography, and at least some of the military arts. There were differences from today's practices too. Young Ibn Battuta's most important goal, as for most young students of his time, was to learn the Quran by heart. He refers many times in the Rihla to reciting the entire Quran aloud in one day while traveling. Knowledge of the Quran took precedence over all other intellectual pursuits, and students, whose means permitted, traveled from one end of Darul Islam to the other to learn its subtleties and its interpretation from the wisest men of the day. Every provincial scholar who desired distinction at home aspired to study in Makkatul Mukarrama, Madinatul Munawwara, Baghdad, Damascus, and Cairo, a kind of scholarly grand tour. Wandering scholars were given modest free meals and a place to stay in the madrasas that dotted the Muslim world. Or, if no better accommodation were available, they slept on mosque floors. No institutional degrees existed. Instead, the student received a certificate from his teachers. The highest accolade was adah, meaning one who is adept at manners, taste, wit, grace, gentility, and above all, knowledge carried lightly. Ibn Battuta's knowledge of the subtleties of Arabic identified him anywhere as an educated gentleman. But Tangier was not one of the great centers of learning. So, armed with his earnest but hardly world-tested knowledge, Ibn Battuta set out eastward from Tangier to make his first Hajj. In the words he dictated to his scribe 3 decades later, one can still detect both youthful excitement and unease.
I set out alone, having neither fellow traveler in whose companionship I might find cheer, no caravan whose party I might join, but swayed by an overmastering impulse within me, and a desire long cherished in my bosom to visit these illustrious sanctuaries. So I braced my resolution to quit all my dear ones and forsook my home as birds forsake their nests. My parents being yet in the bonds of life, it weighed sorely upon me to part from them. And both they and I were inflicted with sorrow at the separation.
Join us in part 9 as we introduce you to Ibn Battuta, the world traveler, inshallah.
The Global Village has been researched and compiled by Hafidha Rayhana Umar, narrated by Tufail Patel, overseen by Mufti Yusuf Musaji, a production of Radio Islam.